What does Putin want? And how has Western foreign policy influenced his actions? A few days ago, I spoke to Dr. Afzal Ashram, a former senior government advisor and an expert in global security here at Loughborough. He told me about what drives Putin and how the West's military strategy might need to change in order to succeed in modern day warfare. Okay, so hello, Afzal, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I think a bit rushed, but fine, thanks.
I think a good place to start is if you could give us a bit of history, a bit of background, and set the scene as to how it all came about, because it shouldn't have come as a surprise to a lot of people that Putin wanted to invade Ukraine, and people have known about it for a long time. Why did no one act, or did people act in the past?
Well, I'm not sure that Putin really wanted to invade Ukraine, certainly not the whole of the country. He has wanted certain security guarantees, which have evolved ever since the fall of the Soviet Union. There was a tacit understanding when the Soviet Union collapsed between Russia and NATO, that NATO would not expand eastwards. And certainly that was an understanding that was never articulated in any form of formal agreement, but it was there. And the Russians have seen with growing alarm, and that's been continuing for about 15 years or more, is the eastward expansion of NATO. And also they've seen Western foreign policy evolving into a much more intrusive and expansionist way in other parts of the world, obviously the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on. And one of their strategists, General Gerasimov, their supreme strategist, has put this whole together, these events together, as part of a theory of expansion and encirclement of the only countries that aren't within, if you like, the Western influence, aren't beholden to the West through financial and other means. And he's postulated that Iran, China, and Russia are the main targets because they're the only real opposition to Western hegemony. And so there is a powerful theory based on quite a lot of evidence. And certainly it's one that's believed by a very large number of people, even people in countries that at the government level are very supportive of the West because they have very little choice. But at the popular level, a lot of people in the world are getting a little bit fearful of this dominance that the United States of America has on Western on world politics. And they have interpreted what have been called the color revolutions in Eastern Europe as CIA-inspired revolutions to install governments in power that they believe are more compliant with the West. And certainly the results support that theory, whether that is what has happened or not. And of course, the West can deny any involvement, and maybe with good reason. The problem, of course, is that the history of Western involvement in regime change is overwhelming. And so the question arises in the minds of non-Western people as well, have you really changed? What has changed? And the West hasn't really said we have actually changed. We're never going to get involved in regime change as they did in Iran, where a democratic leader in the 50s was replaced by the Shah, who was very repressive and so on. And even if you do research, you find that the Ayatollahs were put into power with assistance from the West, simply because the alternative was a communist regime, which was likely to come into power, and they couldn't, they had to choose between what they considered the lesser of the two evils. And so I think that narrative is there, and that's a narrative that drives people like Putin greatly. And so I think that this lack of dignity, this lack of feeling that they are a power in their own right that shouldn't be threatened or put themselves in a situation where an external power might determine or influence their destiny is what's driven this thing. And of course, that's the background. So what we see in 2014 is that he takes over Crimea, which historically, I think there is a reasonable, if you like, claim that was Russian, certainly Russian in population terms. And I think he has made it clear since that that Ukraine should not become closer to the West, either through EU membership or NATO membership, but particularly NATO membership. And unfortunately, the West has ignored this. And it's ignored the request not just of the Russians, it's ignored the advice of the arch realist thinker Mearsheimer, who is a political philosopher who's warned against NATO expansion, because the logic of realism is that the power balance is a zero sum game. If you increase your influence and your power, then the other side feels threatened by it because they're their power and influence decreases. And much more significantly, the archetypal realist strategist who has shaped geopolitics as it exists today more than anybody else in the world is Henry Kissinger. And Henry Kissinger has said far back as 2014, NATO should not expand further. Otherwise, the Soviets will feel threatened.
He's gone into Ukraine now? Is it tactical, or has he just had no choice? Is it if Ukraine become a member of NATO, then it's already too late? Has he been left no choice?
I think that's
In his eyes,
of course, yes. And of course, we know that before this invasion that started about 25, 26 days ago, he spent several weeks, 3 weeks or so, 2 to 3 weeks with this military exercise, which was overtly threatening, and the West recognized it. And I think he was hoping that people will say, okay, let's discuss possible neutrality. And now I think this affair is designed to achieve some form of political settlement that will get him what he wants. And I think we've heard already the meetings that have taken place between the Ukrainians and the Russians that Ukrainian neutrality is one of the key things that Putin wants. And there has been progress, and the Ukrainians, President Zelensky has accepted that is a possibility. And so I think we're making progress on that. There are other demands that I think this denazification, which is an issue that sounds bizarre to a lot of people.
Can you explain that? What did Putin mean when he said he wants to denazify Ukraine? What were his reasons?
Well, because there is a Nazi influence, there are right-wing extremists in Ukraine. They've been there for around a decade or so. And the only difference between President Putin and the West is that the West regards these as peripheral extremists who have very little influence. And President Putin feels that they do have a great deal of influence. And what these people do is that they're ultra-nationalist in their outlook. And they do have very strong links with Nazis through history, through the Second World War. And many of them have outwardly praised Hitler. They have the insignias that the Nazis had, and they go around with that. And what I think President Putin is really concerned about, and I think many Ukrainians are, is that in Ukraine, of course, you've got two linguistic groups primarily. You've got the Russians and the Ukrainian speaking people. And the one of the demands of the Nazis is that we will eliminate, if you like, Russian as a language, but also possibly Russian speaking people, because they're not truly Ukrainian in their eyes. So you've got these demands, which Of course, both sides.
Do you think Putin really believes that, or do you think he's just using that as a political tool or a reason for invasion?
I think that he's not really used that, although he's used it, if you like, rhetorically quite a great deal. But the real reason for the invasion is, as I've described, it is to avoid any membership of NATO. I think, yes, he's using that primarily to mobilize support within Ukraine, because there's a lot of Russian speakers in Ukraine, and also to mobilize support amongst the West, because clearly in Western countries, most people don't ever want to see the rise of Nazism again. And indeed, I think he's very intelligently speaking to a highly influential and an important audience for him, and that's the Jewish diaspora, which is influential in the United States, but particularly in Israel. And this is a part, I think, of the reason why Israel has taken a fairly neutral stance on this, because I do feel that apart from the political relationships that exist between Israel and Russia, the Israelis do have a concern. They, for totally understandable reasons, don't say, well, these guys are a minority party, because, of course, the original Nazi party was a minority party until they got power. And so I think they're less likely to underplay the threat from what may, in fact, be relatively small groups of extremists.
And we saw some rather sort of barbaric shelling of a shopping centre. I think the Russians were using new types of missiles, and it felt like a real show of strength. And then there was the call for the surrender of some of the Ukrainian troops. Do you think you can maybe tell a little bit about how Putin is feeling by what he's doing? Do you think he's upped the level of assault because he might be feeling like he's losing, or he needs something to show that he's more powerful?
Well, those are sort of theories out there. And I think those theories, like all the theories that Western analysts put forward, assume a logic that is consistent with Western thinking. I'm just keeping an open mind. I think there's a great danger in projecting our mindsets and our, if you like, logic onto others. I rather suspect that President Putin is doing is playing a subtle game where he's escalating, if you like, the fear and terror amongst the population to just a reasonable level, the level that he feels is necessary to make people want to either leave the country or to put pressure on the local governments in the cities that they're in to give up. And I think that that's his game. I think that's what he has primarily played from the outset. People are saying that he couldn't capture cities like Kyiv and others because of logistical issues, and that may well be true. But I doubt it. I think that even if there were logistical issues, you can sort those out in a week or so. But the problem, I think, is that he knows from his experience, the Russian experience in cities like Grozny, where the tanks were torn to shreds by just handheld rocket-propelled grenades. And now, of course, the West has flooded Ukraine with very high levels of weaponry, anti-tank weaponry. No tank could survive in any city, really. And so that's one of the reasons why he is just staging a menacing presence without actually getting too close to the cities, I'm guessing. But I think
following a pattern, do any of his previous wars sort of tell us anything about what he might do next, say something he's done in Syria? Is he following any kind of logical progression?
No, I don't think there is anything that I can see. Syria is brought up quite frequently. In Syria, one of the things he the Russians did, very interestingly, was I think they got involved in October, and by November, they were releasing pictures targeting oil refineries that had been taken over by ISIS. These are Syrian oil refineries that have been taken over by ISIS. And of course, that raises the question why the Western coalition hadn't done that, and why the Western coalition with superior intelligence and ISTAR capabilities, that's, you know, intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance and targeting capabilities, which are far better than the Russians, didn't do that, indicates that the West had other priorities, which was regime change rather than actually fighting ISIS, which is what was publicly the reason for the West getting involved in Syria was. And I think I think what the Russians indicate from that strategy is that they have a sort of a non-rhetorical approach. They're very single-minded about what they want to achieve. And I think that in this particular scenario, what he if it's not his primary objective, certainly his secondary operational objective has been to create this mass outflux of refugees, which is going to cause, certainly in the medium to long term, Europe huge problems, because, you know, it's an economic damaging thing for them. Politically, it'll be very damaging because already there are right-wing parties in many European countries who are fed up of the number of refugees they've had from other wars in the Middle East and so on. The economics, I think he wants those economics to bite, because already President Trump is making a lot of noises, saying, you know, when I was in power, oil was $36 a barrel, and now it's 100. It could go up to 150. Basically, if you bring me back to power, none of this will happen. And people, ultimately, I mean, the sympathy is very moving that people have had for the refugees, and that's an area that we can explore in more detail if you like. But the problem is that, you know, in a few months' time, when my bill, which is my energy bill, which has gone from just under 2,000 to 5,000 is the projected figure. You know, we're all going to be really very much concerned about basic necessities for us. And I think we will see a public backlash because, again, we've gone into a war just like all our previous wars without really thinking through a strategy. And I think that's what he's banking on, is the mistakes, strategic mistakes made by, if you like, the West, rather than the strategic successes that he might deliver on the ground.
Can you talk a little bit about that then? Explain our sort of strategic pattern since, I think when we spoke before, you mentioned Vietnam and the West not being very successful in any of its conflicts. Can you talk a little bit about that and then explain how that affects this current situation?
Well, I think the lesson from Vietnam is that the architect of the Vietnam campaign, McNamara, discovered to his huge surprise after the defeat in Vietnam, he had lunch with his opposite number, I forgot the name of the Vietnamese general, and it was at that lunch you know, when McNamara said to him, you know, we were fighting to stop communism, he said, well, I don't know, we weren't fighting to spread communism, we were fighting to stop you as Western imperialists, because we've had the bad experience with the French, and we didn't want to become, we didn't want you, the United States, to be another imperial power ruling over us. So here you've got a good example of what, you know, how America went into a war without actually realizing what the enemy was fighting for, and just projecting their own thoughts on the enemy. And I think there's a great maxim that all military leaders and all business leaders should really know from this ancient strategy, Sun Tzu, and that is that where he says that know yourself and know your enemy and you will not be defeated in 1,000 battles. Now, what he's basically saying is, the first thing in warfare is to understand yourself and your enemy, which means knowing what your enemy's fighting for, knowing what you are fighting for. And I think we see this pattern again and again throughout the wars. There are two things that come from Vietnam, and we look at the wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan as well. One is this inability to understand the rationale and the capabilities that we have and the assumptions we in the West have about the world, as well as the opponent. And that's at the strategic level. At the operational level, surprisingly enough, in Vietnam, nobody understood the need to develop a counterinsurgency strategy. So the Western thinking still is molded by the Second World War, where big tank battles are assumed, and even we all have parachute regiments and so on, even though none have really been effectively used, with the exception of Suez very briefly in battle. And so this idea of how to fight wars is something that's bizarrely out of date. In fact, it was about 10, 12, 15 years ago that the General Petraeus was given a couple of years of leave to go away and write the US's first ever counterinsurgency manual. You think about that. That was only just over a decade ago that he came up with this manual. And that was, again, hard for lesson in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I can tell you, having sort of looked at that manual very briefly, that is out of date. That was out of date when it was written, because it was written based around lessons from Malaya and elsewhere that don't no longer apply. So the Western way of war and the Western strategic analysis of the world is sadly way past its sell-by date. And that's one of the major problems we're facing. And so, yes, it's a topic that we can speak about hugely, but to very simply describe it, there is a lack of understanding in the West of the mindset and the motivations, and motivation is very important, of the so-called enemy, as well as the mindset and the motivations of its own approach. And what the one big lesson in the, if you like, the way the West sees its own approach is that it has packaged increasingly what are realist objectives, maximization of power, in humanitarian terms for a democratic audience. We intervene for humanitarian reasons, to give people liberty and freedom, but in the process we end up killing far more people than the dictators that we're trying to replace. And that certainly was the case in Iraq and in Afghanistan. The dictatorial regime, the Taliban, never killed as many people as were killed during the conflicts. And we end up antagonizing a far greater number of people across the world. Of course, all the Middle East governments are outwardly supporting, apart from the UAE, this conflict. But the people of those countries are becoming increasingly anti-Western because they see this as a violent part of the world, a hugely violent part of the world, which uses, very high ethical arguments, but actually delivers a great deal of violence and harm. And one of the great things and one of the positive things about this this conflict is that we're now seeing the suffering of ordinary people. Yesterday, BBC News report, the reporter said, if there's a hell on earth, this is it, reporting from a town in Ukraine. The fact is that even today, the hell on earth is in Yemen, where a poor country is having its buildings demolished and shelled and bombed, and children and elderly people and women are being dragged out the rubble. The difference is that we don't see it. And if you do see it, and it is reported via the BBC, it's not reported in such a way that we can relate to it. So they become inadvertently, I'm not accusing the BBC of doing this, but inadvertently they become, if you like, lesser human beings. And I'm hoping that as a result of this, we will start seeing every conflict as a danger and every human being's life as precious. And we will be able to relate more to people who don't look like us, as it were, but who are suffering in many ways far more through conflicts than they are in the Ukraine.
Going back slightly to something you said about us not understanding the mindset of the enemy, do you think there is a flip side to that, and Putin actually does have a grasp on how we think and knows what we're going to do before we do?
I'm not sure about that. It's possible. I don't think there's anything I've seen. In fact, quite the opposite. I thought that he would, because he's prepared for this. He's set up an organization, and Gerasimov, General Gerasimov, who I mentioned earlier, has written about this. There is quite a lot of thinking that's gone on with this. And there's an organization or a center in Moscow that tries to blend, if you like, messaging as well as operations on the ground, as well as intelligence. But the performance has been very poor, I think, on the whole. So the strength, if there is one, and that is that he is single-minded. And there is another strategic maxim that all military commanders, certainly in the West, should have come across. And that is that the single factor that leads to success is the identification and maintenance of a single aim. So if you're clear about what you want to achieve and you focus your energies on that, then you are more likely to succeed than if you are just a little bit confused and you've got several competing aims and you might go from one to the other. And that's something we see in the European context, particularly, but in the United States context as well, because wars there is what I describe, and I hope I'll be able to write about this, the triumph of narrative over strategy. There is no strategic thinking. There is a strategy, and often it's 100% successful in deploying to a country to achieve a particular military objective. That's no problem, that's done. But there's no political strategy to deliver success. And that's one of the reasons why the West has failed in just about every single war that it's embarked on, with a couple of exceptions in Kosovo and Sierra Leone, which have been minor and have been wars that have, if you like, engaged in early with very clear objectives, and disengaged early as well, having delivered them. And neither of them involved significant boots on the ground, which is the opposite of what we're seeing in the major wars. And of course, by boots on the ground, proxy forces, which is what we now have in Ukraine. By the way, in those proxy forces, we mustn't assume that there are, if you like, there is absolutely no Western presence on the ground. I'm almost 100% certain that Ukrainian defense forces are getting Western intelligence. Why wouldn't they? And why wouldn't the West give it to them? And that's something I think almost anybody can predict. Because if we're giving them arms, why can't we just give them information on where the Russian forces are and where is the best place to attack them from? And of course, the other thing that I think people don't really understand, and that's observable from an ex-colleague of mine, research, Professor Rory Cormack, who's at the University of Nottingham. He and several other academics have done a lot of research. And based on that research, my conclusion is that the proportion of covert operations in relation to overt military operations used to be small. Now it's increasingly a greater proportion. And of course, we don't know and probably will not know for maybe a decade or two. But based on that research, I think it would be reasonable to assume that the West has an element of covert capability there assisting the Ukrainians. And I say that's that's not giving away any secrets. I'm sure the Russians know this even better, This research that I mentioned is publicly available, and they would have read it. And there's a very significant history of Western covert operations, most of which actually ironically have failed miserably. But, it is something that Western leaders do pride themselves on and like to deploy it whenever they can. And of course, it does have tactical phenomenal successes, although strategically, there are very few examples where it succeeded massively.
Okay, finally then, do you think when this war finally does finish, do you think Putin will go away thinking that he has achieved what he aimed to do? Do you think he will be, do you think he will regret invading Ukraine? What do you think he'll be thinking about?
Well, of course, that very much depends on how it ends. If it ends well for him, he'll be cock-a-hoot. He would think that's exactly what I should have done maybe a few years ago.
Is it going the way he's thought, though? I mean, the talks that people are having at the minute, Zelensky's saying that, yes, there's a chance that we will stay neutral. Is this what he's been aiming for? Will he be happy?
I think he will be happy. That's his primary objective. And I think there's no secret about that. If he can get a constitutional amendment that Ukraine will be neutral, then that's fine. I think that he will be aware that he will also want territory around Mariupol and other areas. And the reason for that, and I don't think people have spoken about this, and I think it may be an interesting thing to very briefly identify, and that is that Russia is bottlenecked. The Russian Navy is bottlenecked. So there's a northern, if you like, outlet, which means that the Russian Navy can come out of the what's called the Baltic Gap between the Scandinavian countries. And that makes them very vulnerable to attack. But also they can only use the northern, if you like, ports for a certain number of months a year because of ice and so on. And so their only warm weather port is in the Black Sea. And I think that is something that people don't understand why he is very keen. He wants to ensure that his Navy is not vulnerable to NATO forces strangling, if you like, its ports. And so I think that he will be wanting to retain some of that those strips of land as well that he's recovered or he's captured. And I think that beyond that, he will see this as if he gets that agreement, a victory, but he will be very mindful, knowing the way the West operates, that this is a not necessarily a sustainable victory, and that the West will be out to destroy him, because the West is also very paranoid, just like the Russians. So the Western alliance, I can see you're surprised, has used more violence than any other, alliance in the history of mankind. It's the only alliance that has used nuclear weapons. It dropped more bombs on Korea than were dropped in the Second World War. Countless number of people were killed. We don't count, unfortunately, we can't count the number of dead and wounded in those conflicts very accurately. Of course, in Vietnam, you're familiar with the numbers of people that were killed and bombed, napalm and other very nasty weapons were used. Agent Orange was used, the effects of which are still continuing. So the point I think we have to understand and recognize is that there is a real fear in the West. And because of the way the West sees Putin as a dictator, and he's been represented as a megalomaniac, and that's something that the West often genuinely sees, Hitler as an unhinged leader that led his country astray. Putin in a similar light, Saddam, Gaddafi, and so on. The point is that Hitler led one of the most advanced, philosophically and scientifically advanced nations in the world, who went the way they did, not just because of the charismatic personality and the thugs that Hitler has under his command. They're too intelligent for that. They were seduced because there was what I call the no dignity in defeat after the First World War. And the situation in Russia and Putin is very similar. The West didn't treat Russia with the dignity that the Russians believe they are due as an ancient civilization in their own right. Everybody needs to feel good about themselves. And I think that is one of the things that is missing from the Western, if you like, concept and understanding of itself. And so Putin will be well aware of this. And so what we will see is if we get a peaceful resolution, which we, of course, all hope and pray for, then the what we will have is not an end of conflict, we'll have a transformation of conflict. And that is something we see in other conflicts in Iraq and in Afghanistan. They haven't ended, they're just transformed. And so what we will see is a transformation of conflict. And Putin's next priority would be ensuring that those economic sanctions are lifted and eliminated. And here, I think the West has scored a bit of an own goal, because what it has done is to reverse what President Nixon and Kissinger did many years ago in the 1970s, by driving China and the Soviet Union apart. What President Biden has done is to drive China and Russia together. They're not necessarily good bedfellows. And one of the pains, the emotional pains that President Putin feels is he sees himself as a European. He doesn't see himself as an Easterner, but he has no choice. And so we now have these two blocks forming with their own, if you like, financial systems, the equivalent of SWIFT, etc. The end maybe of the petrodollar, which is going to have phenomenally negative effects on the United States in particular, but in Western economies in general. And we see that many of the oil producers, the Saudis and so on, are increasingly keeping, not necessarily in taking sides, but they're taking a neutral stance because they don't trust in the success and the continuing sustainability of Western hegemony. So I think that we have to think about these longer term strategic issues before we can say, this is how it'll end and this is how he'll behave. So in a short answer to your question, the end of hostilities in Ukraine will mean the beginning of a wider economic and political conflict elsewhere.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Afzal. Thank you for listening or watching if you're on YouTube. This show is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all other platforms. I hope you join us again.